If you can put capital in the street every year over the next 10, 20, 30 years, you're going to do just fine. Understanding market cycles has been a really big impact on how I invest today. We're still fundamentally buying multifamily. We're still fundamentally operators, but we also understand that we need to be in other businesses to make it an even more powerful portfolio.
Welcome to Investing in the US, a podcast for real estate investors, business owners, and aspiring entrepreneurs looking to grow their wealth by investing in US real estate. I'm your host, Reid Goossens, and so far, I've acquired over $800 million worth of investments on various properties across the United States. On this podcast, I interview go-getters, risk takers, and the best in the business to learn more about their investment journey and the cutting-edge strategies they are applying towards building a legacy. For more on growing your own wealth and by investing in the US, visit www.reidgoossens.com.
I'm really excited to chat with today's guest. Now, this is someone I've had the pleasure of knowing for almost 10 years now. We actually met in person back at the very first Best Ever Conference. And I've told him this before, I believe, but Reid is actually the person responsible for convincing me to get into the podcast game myself. As welcome to the show, Reid Goossens.
John, how you going, mate? I do remember that. I think last time we were on the show, you were telling me exactly that thing. So thanks for reminding me, and it makes me blush.
Yeah, you know what, man? It's great because I think oftentimes you get into the space of podcasting and most of us do it because it helps our business, right? It's a great thought leadership thing to do, helps you get in front of investors, but we also make an impact on other people who are listening. And sometimes it's hard to quantify that, right? Because you're kind of talking to this microphone, you're talking to a camera, and you know, you and I are talking to each other, but you have no context of like how many people are listening or how many people you may impact. And it's really just reassuring to understand the impact, the power that your words have and the inspiration you can set. With that said, Reid, let's set the stage for folks who are not familiar with you. Tell us a little bit about yourself and give us kind of your 30-second bio.
Yeah, look, moved here in 2012. I moved here to chase a girl. She's now my wife. So it all worked out really, really well. And I moved here not with any particular hope to get into multifamily. I just stumbled into it. Unique thing to the US in terms of I couldn't go and buy 200 units in Australia. I couldn't go buy 200 units in Europe. So very interesting asset class. Been in this space for over 11 years now. Started RSN Property Group. We're a syndication company or private equity company. We've done over 30 deals to date, nearly $1 billion in terms of total transaction volume. And we're like yourself, we're slowly adding different verticals to the business. It's been an incredible run over the last 10 to 12 years. And yeah, just really excited to sort of be back on the show and to share the knowledge with the folks who are listening. Cause you know, as you said in the intro, like making impact on someone is why we do this, why we build brands, why we do podcasting. And hopefully we can continue to do that on this show today.
And one of the things I love about, you know, kind of your story and where you're at is, you know, we talk about multifamily mastery. It's recognizing that things change. Things always evolve. And what worked 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 2 years ago may not work today. So it's recognizing that you kind of have to be on this commitment of being a lifelong learner and recognizing that the economy shifts and changes, your market conditions can change, relationships change, you know, you age and get older. So things that you didn't care about 10 years ago are really important to you today. Talk to us from your perspective. How has your investing view changed over the last 10 years?
My investing view is that you always have to be placing capital on the street, you know, in a wise sense, in an educated sense, every year. If you can put capital in the street every year over the next 20, 10, 20, 30 years, you're going to do just fine. I think there's, you know, understanding market cycles has been a really big impact on how I invest today. Looking at other indicators outside of just growth, and really supplementing real estate as a business with other more, I wouldn't say sustainable, but more, I'm going to use the word sustainable income methods. You know, there's a whole lot of things in there that I now do today differently that I did compared to what I did, you know, 10, 11, 12 years ago. We're still fundamentally buying multifamily. We're still fundamentally operators, but we also understand that we need to be in other businesses to make the ecosystem really, really work well. And so for those folks listening in terms of mastery, 100% focus on, if you're really bullish on multifamily, definitely focus on it, build out your power, your understanding of it. And then, like, as I have, as you have, you start to add different things to the ecosystem to make it an even more powerful portfolio, which I'm sure we can dive into as well in terms of how we're doing that and what we're doing with that today.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's start with kind of, you know, setting the stage for where you're at today. And then I definitely want to dive into more of these verticals that you're adding. So as it sits today, kind of talk to us about the portfolio. Where are you finding success? Where are you seeing some pushback or challenges in the market? Talk to us about kind of how things are performing right now.
Well, you and I probably got started around the same time, and we saw a golden decade of multifamily, right? Like, there was interest rates were cheap coming out of 08, and we ran up to sort of the peak. We had COVID hit. We had all the stimulus money. And then we've had a bit of a reset, right? In certain markets and certain, you know, growth markets, we thought that were not going to be impacted. And we've had a lot of supply, and we've probably had the most amount of supply compared to what we did as back in the 1970s, where we also had inflationary problems. So I think that's been a big lesson for me in terms of how I'm investing and what type of debt products you're putting on the property. You know, a lot of people got floating rate debt a couple of years back at the peak, and that has, you know, come to bite them in the ass a little bit. I've seen, you know, the hysteria around multi in terms of retail investing die off, and in terms of institutional investing, because we've seen a lot of supply and, you know, interest rates go a lot higher, which means asset values come down. And the last couple of years has been very quiet. You know, a lot of people are on the sidelines still. We've still been active. We've bought 850 units in the last 12 months, which has been pretty good. But I will say equity raising is challenging, right? From the retail investors, I think folks are starting to realize, you know, that they may be tapped out in terms of our allocation on commercial real estate. So trying to, you know, attract new people to the space, I think right now is a very good time to be buying multifamily. Like, if we look at, like, we've gone back into a rate cutting cycle. So I think we're at or near the bottom, and supply is drying up. So if you are getting started in listening to this podcast, I think it's a great time to be picking up some pretty good assets at some, you know, historically low pricing in some of the Sunbelt markets, if that's where you're looking. A lot has changed over the last 10 years, which is good. I think the other thing to talk about is, you know, why has things changed? I remember when you and I first got started, John, like, technology's really, really had an outweighed impact on the space. And I'm talking about access of people coming into the industry. So the Jobs Act that changed in 2012, I'm talking about the technology around how do you compare different asset classes in terms of rents or, you know, price per square foot. That's been in a click of a button where, you know, historically you might have had to do a little bit more guerrilla marketing to find out that. So the barrier to entry has really come down a lot, and that is through technology. That's a good thing, right? But it's also created a busier space. People have understood the value of commercial real estate and being a, you know, not really an alternative asset anymore. So you've got the big players of the institutions coming into the space. And that's all, you know, then add on top COVID, add on top, you know, inflation. That's really, you know, played a bit of a rocky road on the last couple of years, which all makes for good opportunities for us moving forward. So I've said a lot there, but that's, you know, where we are today, what we're doing, and how we've come sort of full circle over the last 10 years.
I think it's important to note the changes, right? Especially when you talk about cycles and kind of, you know, things that have happened in the past. I know a lot of times it's easy to look into economic cycles and trends and say, okay, this happened in the 70s and this is going to happen again, or this happens every 10 years. And there's a lot of value in that information. But you said something that I think is really important too. You have to also recognize both the technological changes that have happened as well as the policy changes that have taken place and how that may impact cycles, investor sentiment, overall demand. And to your point, it's easier to invest in multifamily today than it was 10, 15, 20 years ago because of the Jobs Act, because of, you know, social media and so many things. It's so much easier just to, you know, go online and do some quick research, learn about a market, find an operator, wire some funds, and never meet someone, never visit the property and make an investment. And when you had such a long run up like we did over the last 15 years, you know, it felt like an investment that couldn't lose. And for a lot of investors, when you see that, especially on social media, you can get excited and you can, you know, not want to miss out, right? You got that FOMO component, and people started investing, and now we've had a reset. where it's maybe not as attractive. It's not this, you know, fail safe investment. And some of those fundamentals come back into play. You are an operator at heart. You know, I know we first started working together and getting to know each other. You've spent a lot of time on the construction side, order materials and understanding kind of, you know, the real, you know, feet hit the ground component of real estate investing. How have you seen the operation side shift? And more importantly, I guess the importance of operations shift over the last, say, 5 years.
Yeah, well, I think that's another interesting point, because when you think about the, we'll call it the ease, right? Like the professionalism of property management has also come a long way through technology, right? So when you think about the business in a box, you know, there's not many other businesses out there that, you know, maybe please comment in the notes, but you go out and buy a large multifamily, you search for a local property manager to run the day to day, and you sit back and collect the cash flow. Like that's the pitch, right? There's not many other businesses out there that has systemized that platform of the property management space where you can go into any market and, you know, partner up with a local person to run the day to day. That's very key, because that has changed in the last 10 years, and that has become so much more professional. And we're just doing budgets right now for budget season, and it's, you know, rents are staying relatively flat, but my expenses are going up. The cost of a labor on site went, you know, it used to be $18, $19 an hour. And now we've got to be spending $26, $20, $27 an hour. You know, property management, the day to day, is a thankless business, right? You're, particularly if you're in the sort of workforce housing, it's become this, you know, very much a struggle. When I'm talking with my property managers and I'm seeing, like, I was just looking at the other day, I was looking at health insurance for the employees on site, right? Like, if you don't know, property managers have the best business in the world. They don't have any of the payroll. They don't have any of the burden. They put it all on the properties, which was what we own, right? So technically I own these payrolls. I own these employees, but they're not my employees, right? And I was looking at health insurance, and I want people to have health insurance, but it went up 46%. In the state of Texas. And I was like, what the hell? Like, on one of my properties, I'm spending nearly $60,000 a year just on employee health insurance. And I was like, whoa. And I can't control that. I can't not say to my property manager, hey, don't offer health insurance, because then I won't attract good talent, because then I won't get the best people on site. So it's become a real dogfight in the getting good people on site to manage well. And when, you know, you go back to a sort of a stagnant or negative rent growth market, but expenses are going up, it starts to really, really stress that underwriting. So how we've been going, so back to your question, there's been a lot more professionalism in the property management space. There's been a lot more consolidation, but the cost of that has also gone up significantly. Insurance, think about, like, I remember when I first got started 10 years ago, I was paying $200, $300 a door per unit in the state of Texas. I'm now paying $1,200 a door, right? So it's just these things that I can't control that are starting to really eat away at my profitability. So you have to really understand your numbers. And that's where having an active portfolio, knowing literally what my year-on-year growth is going to be, or how I'm underwriting a new deal, when I can look at data from my existing deals, and I can make a more educated decision. Folks coming into the industry, you know, might be getting these online tools, and if the numbers turn green, it's a fantastic deal, like all this sort of stuff. I think if you're buying positive leverage deals today, and what I mean by positive leverage, you're going with a 6 cap or 6.5 cap, you're getting interest rates at 5, by and large, that's a pretty good deal. Now, you've got to get into the minutiae of operating costs and all that sort of stuff, and you need those property management partners. But in the last sort of 5 to 6 years, it has become a bit of a knife fight to find a good property manager and to find good talent on site, because of all the other issues we're having. Inflation, you know, it's hard for people to keep food on the table. It's, you know, harder for people to be employed. So I don't know if that answers your question, John, but a lot that I unpack and that has evolved in the last sort of 7 to 10 years.
Yeah, I mean, two sides of that coin, right? One is the underwriting component, which is, you know, your assumptions going into it. And I love your point, Chuckle, when you talk about, you know, some of these models where you put in the numbers, everything turns green, you go out and buy the deal. Those are great, right? But those figures, those models are only as good as the assumptions that you put in. And I love the way you called it out, because when I was starting out, same thing, you know, people use $200 per door or $200 per unit as kind of a benchmark for what you should expect for insurance. Listen, if you use $200 per unit for insurance now, you are just setting yourself up to get your ass kicked. I mean, that's just not the case, especially when you talk about Texas or Florida and some of those coastal markets. You know, that's a challenge. And then that's just the premium. That doesn't get into the actual coverage and making sure you got the right insurance program. Like, there's so many other components, and that's just one line item. That's just insurance. There's so many other line items that you have to understand. And that goes into what you're getting at. You kind of have to just stay involved, right? You've got to be underwriting deals. You have to stay close to the market. You have to understand what's changing, why it's changing. Is it likely to come back? Those are all things that you only know if you're in the game. If you are sitting on the sideline waiting, all this stuff is happening. And by the time you get back in, you're going to be so out of practice, you won't even know what levers to pull. So that's just the underwriting component. The other side of it gets into the reality. Talk about labor. You're talking about people. You're talking about, you know, retaining great talent. That becomes another challenge, right? Where we're in a world where technology is taking away some of these jobs. We know we have a workforce that is looking to get paid. Minimum wage keeps going up. There's a lot of different components that are in play here. So it definitely is a challenge for those folks who are not actively managing their portfolio. You know, you talked about there was this approach where people could buy a property anywhere in the country, hire a local manager, and be able to thrive and find success. Are you seeing that that is still the case today, or has that shifted where you really need to be more hands-on?
Oh, we conducted the asset management, so we're overseeing the day-to-day of the property management. But I don't have one deal across six different MSAs that is just like, you know, punch that check, right? Even with fixed rate debt, even with positive leverage day one, it definitely helps, but you have to be on top of that stuff 24/7. And look, think of it this way, and I don't want to be negative and poo-pooing, but I would go out and buy a $30 million deal. I'm hiring someone to run that asset, $60,000, $65,000. That's a $30 million business, right? Like, you wouldn't go out and buy a $30 million business and hire someone who's a CEO for $65,000. So the short answer is, yes, I have to have other people, other asset managers, including myself, overseeing the day-to-day of that property manager to make sure he or she is doing the right thing. And that comes down to KPIs, systemizing, you know, how our lease is going, how's our traffic going, what are the applications, where our rents are today, like literally lifetime tracking of that stuff. And, you know, holding their feet to the fire, making sure that they're controlling expenses when they can. All of that requires, I've got full-time asset managers who do that day in, day out, and they're across all of our properties. There's not a world where you can just go and buy a deal, get the local property manager to punch the clock and, you know, sit back and collect the checks. Those days, I think, are gone. And the reason they're gone is because there's a lot more competition. And so prices are still surprisingly, pricing has come down, but there's still a lot of people bidding on good deals. Like, I was on a bidding process just recently. There was 30 offers. I was like, whoa, you know, it's insane. It's always hard to buy deals. Like, it was hard to buy deals 10 years ago. It's still hard to buy deals today, right? And so with all the things that we know, it still is hard to buy deals. And that's why it's being consistent with the underwriting, being consistent with still looking at deals. Like, I'm literally got a deal up on my deal sheet right now. Vining's at Duncan Chapel. I looked at this deal 3 years ago. They want $32 million for it. I'm only underwriting to 28 and a half. It's still 28 and a half million bucks. Like, 3 years late, like, nothing's changed. It's gotten even probably worse. And they're still wanting $32 million. I'm like, it's not there. You know, like, good luck to you. And they still haven't sold. There's just a reality of keeping in the game so you see these deals day in, day out, and keeping your pencil sharp. I think that's so important.
You know, you said a couple things that really stand out. One, recognizing that this is a business. And I think that gets lost on so many people, right? We've made this perception of real estate and multifamily investing as a passive opportunity. And for limited partners, absolutely, it's definitely a passive investment. But real estate investing in general is not passive. And you wouldn't hire a CEO of a $30 million business for $60,000, right? Like, you wouldn't do that. Yet people think it's completely acceptable in multifamily. And that's kind of chaotic and a little backwards. And I love the point you make there, because you've got to stay on top of this. You know, this is, it's absolutely a business. It's a business that generates millions of dollars just for that property. And you need someone who understands how to navigate that, how to drive revenue, how to drive revenue growth, how to minimize expenses, how to renegotiate contracts, how to minimize terms. There's a lot of operational things that it takes to really drive success. And it's not as simple as it was maybe a couple of years ago. We just increase the rents 10-15% every year and everybody does great. That's not the case now. You got to actually be able to manage, and that's going to separate the folks who really understand operations from the folks who thought this was really a passive investment and maybe get a little bit of a surprise. The second point you made, though, which stood out to me, is when you talk about the opportunities in the marketplace and staying on top of what's happening, understanding the investor sentiment, what some buyers or some sellers are looking for, expecting the pricing guidance versus where you're at today, there's still a bit of a gap. And it's interesting because I sat down with another investor here locally last week, and he was saying, you know, typically they would look at deals that were on the market and they would be so far out that, you know, they never even got a shot. And then they started making it to best and final. And he's like, well, wait a minute, like, are we overbidding? Did something happen with our underwriting? And they just realized, no, the market just started to finally shift to their valuations. And I think that's one of the things too, is like getting that feedback, especially if you can look at a deal you've already underwritten, right? But even if it's with brokers that you've built relationships with and you know, hey, this broker typically gets top market on his ask, and now you're underwriting deals and you see where your offers are coming in and you're starting to be in that top group. Yeah, you can't look at it and say, hey, am I missing something? But a lot of times, if you stick to your fundamentals, it's not you, it's the market that's shifted, that's realized, hey, we can't go in there and offer, you know, $250,000 hard day one, all cash, right? Like, those crazy offers are not out there today in a way that they were a few years ago. So that certainly has shifted. As you think about kind of your growth and where you're headed, how do you fundamentally approach the business? Like, do you have set deal criteria or certain rules that you follow when you're looking at opportunities in the marketplace?
In general, it's sheer volume, right? Like, 3, 4, 5 years ago, you could probably look at 100 deals. Like, take one step back. What is our goal? Our goal is to buy good deals, and we don't have an ego at RSN to buy 15 deals a year, right? We just don't need to. We don't want to. We're sort of a deal a quarter type of group, right? And that comes down to our source of equity. We still, you know, primarily rely a lot on retail investing. But to find 4 deals a year, maybe you could look at 100 deals, right? So that's now probably 300 deals, right? So it's really sort of tripled. And you just got to turn over a lot more deals. And the other thing is to understand is that and particularly with a softening in the market, is when you see a financial statement, particularly if it's marketed, you bet your bottom dollar that T12 or that trailing 12 months of financials is the skinniest bloody thing in terms of expenses that you've ever seen. Right. And so you've always got to know that there's probably stuff that's shoved below the line there. And maybe they give you that. Right. But what I'm saying is that, like, you've always got to take it with a grain of salt. And I think that's where that bid ask spread, like what you're talking about with your friend, or what I'm seeing on the deal that I'm looking at today, is that I just know the fundamentals of how I operate deals, because I operate 3 or 4 or 5 other deals in that same market, and I can call BS on a payroll number or on a marketing number or on a contracts expenses number. And so just keeping underwriting more deals, knowing your numbers really, really well. And that only comes with time. That only comes with sort of building the calluses on your hands, so to speak, to make sure that you're doing the reps to make sure you're not buying a lemon or a falling knife.
I love it, man. Great insights right there. Let's talk about your focus today, right? So as you know, we're talking early 2026 here. Where are you focused on opportunities, both within real estate and outside of real estate?
Yeah, so as I mentioned earlier, we had to, you know, it's been a slow couple of years. We as a company, I as a CEO, need to sort of figure out other ways to make the business successful, right? And when everything's going well in a hot market, when you're buying 4 deals a year, selling 4 deals a year or whatever, like, everything looks great. But when you're reliant upon deal flow and it doesn't happen because the market stops or softens, that's a problem, right? And I, as a CEO, need to go and figure out another approach, right? And so what I boiled down to what our core competency is we can assess deals, plural, like the word deals, it doesn't need to be real estate. we can build culture and we can, you know, we can market really well and we can drive systems within, you know, think about taking an existing value add deal and making increasing revenue by 30, 40%. You can apply that in a lot of business, different businesses. And so we are starting to look at different businesses. And one of those specific businesses we're looking at is actually CPA firms, accounting practice firms. And we have a strategic partner involved in that. But the reason we started looking outside of that is that, you know, obviously the multifamily space is becoming very hot. It's becoming very hard to, you know, rents are softening, right? So, you know, it's hard to compete. And you were looking for more cash flow heavy businesses with retiring antiquated systems that we can come in very quickly. And the amount of effort we put in has an outsized return on the business. And so, you know, we're looking at CPA firms. And so, you know, take 100 unit property, right? Like my maximum revenue will be capped at whatever the market's going to tell me. On a business, I can say, maybe I say I have 5 employees and each employee, you know, you can look at a revenue per employee. Well, if I add another employee, well, then I've just increased my revenue. I don't have a ceiling right now. There's obviously a lot of caveats to that, buying a business versus a physical asset. I'm not going to get into that. But when you start to break down the fundamentals of the widgets, they're very much aligned in terms of, okay, how do you drive revenue? How do you drive culture? How do you drive marketing? And how do you control expenses? That in itself is a very key aspect that we are starting to roll out in another vertical. And we also think there's a bit of a cross-sell there within those firms who have tax problems. Maybe they can come over into our multi-deals and there's a bit of synergy there. So ecosystem synergies are really important to me now in how we grow the business. I'm not stopping buying multifamily, but I'm going to be more selective. And in the interim, I need to have another couple of verticals to keep the business, you know, going strong.
Reid, I really appreciate you sharing that. A couple fold. One, I have a lot of conversations with investors, particularly folks who are looking to leave their W-2 job and become full-time multifamily investors. But the biggest challenge they face is there's not enough cash flow from their multifamily deals to sustain them. So they're always looking for, well, what else do I do to make money? I mean, this multifamily is great, but if you're an operator, maybe you make an acquisition fee when you buy a deal. If you've got a pref return on your deal, you're probably not making money again. I mean, you get an asset management fee, but you really don't make any money until you go full cycle, right? So for a lot of these people, there's just not enough cash flow through the multifamily business in the early stages. So they're looking for other ways to generate some income on a day-to-day basis. Sounds like your firm has identified some opportunities in this space and with other businesses, particularly in this, you know, CPAs and accounting firms. I'm curious to understand why CPAs and accounting firms as opposed to some other business.
Digital, remote. I don't need to be physical. That's one. Two, AI disruption is going to disrupt the space a lot. Three, they're very profitable with being digital, with in terms of that cost, so the revenue per employee. And four, it's easier to, they're sticky, right? CPAs, people aren't bouncing around, you know, people, once they get a good CPA, they stick with them, right? And CPAs, the firms we're looking at have historically been regional, right? And with, you know, maybe a fraction of their business being more digital, having, you know, folks across the country. And so with certain systems, we can attract folks from across the country. And the last thing I'll say is that the knife fight isn't necessarily about getting clients with CPA businesses. It's actually about finding good talent. And so when you're, you know, like the medical space is very similar. Everyone needs medical. Everyone needs CPA taxes done. Your knife fight, you constantly hear about doctors being in shortage, right? Because it's good creating, attracting good talent. The same is within the accounting firm. Like, you know, you're not hearing a lot of people going to university and like, oh, I'm coming a CPA. You know what I mean? And so creating a culture where you can garner or help grow young talent into leadership roles, and then having a sort of a multi-firms across the country saying, hey, if you want to go live in, like we just bought a firm in New Jersey, we just bought a firm in LA, we're going to start buying stuff in Texas. You know, we can start to say to people, like, do you want to go and either live in those in those states, or do you want to work remotely now that we're sort of all systemizing the business together? That's why I like the businesses versus, say, more of a blue collar. And don't get me wrong, I think blue collar businesses like HVACs are awesome, but they're also location based. And that is where you've got to be a little bit more understanding of the, some of the restrictions that come along with that in terms of creating revenue.
Yeah, I think it's a really good insight recognizing that there's opportunities in that space. The demand is there. The profitability is there. How do you take your background, primarily as a value-add multifamily investor, and bring that lens to the accounting world?
Good question. I just had a conversation with our kind of integrator, right, who's hired, who sort of does the day-to-day. Guess what they're doing? They're doing weekly asset management calls. Guess what they're looking at? Accounts receivable. Guess what they're looking at? Marketing costs. All the same things that we do in the multifamily world. How are the leads? How much traffic did you get this week? How many applications did you have? What's the AR going today? How are you controlling those expenses? Does that not sound very similar to what I just said on the accounting world? It's literally the same line items, but they're just coming from different revenue sources. It's not a rent. The widget is in a box, four walls and a roof. It's a service for doing taxes. And then the other thing we look at is like, you know, it's a little bit different, but similar is like, well, how does your revenue generated through different buckets of people, right? So when we're looking at, okay, well, 20% of the business or 30% or 40% of the business comes from W-2 taxation. Well, we want to really grow taxation and bookkeeping and maybe financial services for businesses. So how many businesses do we serve? Well, we serve 40% of our businesses of this revenue is generated from businesses. Well, how do we go get more of those businesses because they have more recurring revenue? Same on the multi-site. How can we get a little bit more recurring revenue from trash valet or from, you know, adding pet yards or from putting a cable contract in there? All those same things that the ideas you're thinking about of generating revenue. The same with, hey, how's our ILS systems going? How many leads do we attract this quarter? And how many applications did that turn into rents? On the CPA side, how many leads do we get in are coming through the door? Do you even have a CRM, right? I can tell you, John, they don't. This is the thing. The multi-world is actually so advanced. The property management in a box solution is actually quite attractive because you come over to these businesses and you're like, you don't have a CRM. You don't have a tracking system for online leads. Who's following up with your leads? How is your, you don't have an invoicing system. You've got no way to pay online. Like, it's like, it blows your mind. And so when you break it down, so yes, we're multifamily guys. Yes, we're value add, but the fundamentals are the same. How you attract leads, how you control revenue and how you control expenses and how do you get that paid on time? There's a lot of crossover there. Now, I'm not doing the day-to-day accounting. Don't get me wrong. But I'm also not doing the day-to-day leasing. You know what I mean? It has a lot of crossover.
How much time do you think it, let me ask this differently. I think the hesitation people typically would have in venturing into a new business, especially one where they don't have a background, is that knowledge gap. Like you said, you're not an accountant yourself, right? To my knowledge, you're not a CPA, you're not licensed, right? So when you come into that space, yes, it's a business, but without having that accounting / CPA background, there's a little bit of a gap. I think most people stop because of that. You obviously continue to move forward. I'm assuming there's some things put in place to educate yourself. Talk to us about how you were able to overcome that. And for anyone who is thinking of investing in businesses, how do you overcome that gap of, well, I actually don't have the institutional knowledge from doing this for the last 20 years.
And again, institutional knowledge, right? It's not about being a CPA. It's institutional knowledge about running folks, creating KPIs, and holding people accountable. At the end of the day, what we do is human management, whether you own a yard maintenance company, whether you own a HVAC company, whether you're a property management company, whether you're an asset manager overseeing a property management company to make sure that they're all coming to business and tapping their chest and going, I want to work for Reed, right? Those fundamentals are all the same. Now, there are some nuances, right? I will give you that. So part of the buying process of these businesses, the first and foremost, it's not a physical piece of real estate. It's not bricks and mortar, right? It's really, at the end of the day, goodwill. Someone showing up every single day, doing work and getting charged for that work, right? So we need to make sure that they've got a long history. So we're looking at businesses that are typically over 20 years in existence, right? We are also looking at businesses that roll over two things. And because, again, the capital stack is a little different. I can't go get 80% leverage because real estate is so fundamental to what we do that the lending practices can get very high leverage, right, up to 80%. So there are lenders out there that do leverage on businesses, but they're going as high as maybe 40%. And I've got to fill that gap, right? So what we go and get the seller to do a seller carry note, typically of another 40% or 20 to 40%, 20 to 30%. Then we actually get the seller to roll over equity. So as an equity partner into the deal. And then we bring fresh equity to the table. So now the capital stack is completely different. And we now have those sellers as not only partners, but also part of the debt. The second thing we look for is folks that, and you know, it's hard with buying businesses, that you are not just looking to exit. We want someone who's going to stick around. And like when you buy a 12-unit property, it's probably not big enough to have full-time property management. That's why you go and get 100 units. So we're looking at EBITDAs, which is the same thing as NOI, at $1.5 million or above. At a million or less in terms of EBITDA, you've really got what's called key man risk, which is the person selling the business, they sell it, nothing happens, right? You need to keep at a certain size, you will buy a business with an underlying second level of management that you can incentivize to come and take over the business. That's very important. The third thing is we actually have an implementer who is a CPA and is on board as part of our team. And she is responsible for the day-to-day integration. And as we get bigger, we will replace her with a CEO, right? So there is a time and place when we will get to a point where we will replace them with a CEO, but we do have knowledge on our side that, you know, when I'm not Reed Goossens isn't just going to the blind and like, I'm just going to go buy a CPA business. No, I've got someone who has a business prowess. But I was literally just on a call with her and we were talking about, have you ever heard an MMR, a Monday Management Report? You know, where you look at KPIs from your on-site team. We have the exact same thing for accounting firms. So it's slightly different things that you track, but they, at the end of the day, you put the responsibility on the person who's running the day-to-day to report that to you as the asset manager. You have financial review every single month, and you know, budget set, accrual cash books, making sure you're seeing how that is, and holding people to feet to the fire. And you do that in any business you create. So, yeah.
Great stuff, Reed. First of all, the capital stack is very different. Actually, before you get into that, you talked about kind of your criteria, right? You're looking at businesses that have been in existence for 20 years or more because you want to make sure that they're going to be there, right? They're committed to staying in business and they've got a book of business that's repeatable, right? So they've got that book of business there. You're looking at 20 years. You mentioned the capital stack. You cannot go out and get an 80% loan to value out there. So you're going to look at a stack that's a little more creative. You're getting a loan. You're getting seller financing. You're also getting seller to put some of their equity into the loan, and then you're bringing new equity as well. And you're looking at deals where the EBITDA, that's earnings before interest, taxes, I forget what the D and the A are for, depreciation and amortization, sorry, are more than $1.5 million, right? And your point there is that if it's above $1.5 million, there's enough employees where there's another level of senior management where you can actually continue to grow and scale. I imagine if you're under that, you run into some different issues, right? Where maybe that owner that sell that, you know, the owner is wearing maybe multiple hats. Maybe they're the salesperson. Maybe they're the one that owns all the relationships and,
right,
you know, their key accounts are their golf buddies. So the moment, you know, you shut down, maybe they leave. So you run into some different issues there, which is part of what you're getting at. And it's being able to create a system where you can bring in a CEO or you can bring in senior leaders who can step in and run that business. Reed, I want to rewind the clock here because I think that this is really fascinating in it. You know, I've had a lot of conversations like this over the last year or so with a lot of like-minded individuals, and it sounds like we've all kind of reached a similar conclusion where I launched a restoration business. You're getting into the CPA accounting firms. I know a lot of my friends who are not necessarily multifamily investors, but many of them are leaving their W-2 jobs to launch businesses as well. And there's a lot of intrigue in this space. I know that there's so many individuals who are retiring and, you know, walking away. We've got the baby boomers obviously starting to retire. So there are a lot of businesses and a lot of opportunities between technology and AI and so much else that has come online where there is an opportunity if you can have a great vision for disruption in the space. When you started this journey, started thinking about expanding beyond multifamily, walk me through the process that ultimately led you to acquiring accounting firms?
Yeah.
Like, what questions did you ask yourself?
Look, to be honest with you, John, it actually fell a little bit into our lap. So we have partnered up with a, he was my key principal on my very first deal back in 2014. He signed on the note with me. He's an Australian. And so he came along and he has actually built a medical practice M&A. He's got nothing to do with medical. He did a theatrical degree at university, but we've been good mates. We co-wrote a book together. And he moved back to the US to start buying businesses. Ben Gray, my business partner, we were looking at other businesses to buy. And we were looking very heavily at HVAC, at plumbing, at stuff that was very accretive to multi, right? And it was restoration or construction companies or property managers. Like, we looked at a lot of stuff. We also looked at hard money lending. We looked at pref funds. And when Kevin came along and said, "Hey, Reed, we've got some money to deploy, but we're not great at like the capital raising side or the fund management side," that's where it was like, well, this could be a very, very good synergy, right? And what has transpired is that, you know, we have come as a really good cohesive group, the sort of the three of us, through adding a few other folks in, that I tell people, this looks like a shiny new motorcycle. I'm not a motorcycle guy. I don't know how to ride a motorcycle, but it's a shiny one, and I want to turn it on and see if it works, right? So I've got this model. We've built, you know, I've got my underwriting team. They created a whole model around CPA acquisitions. We spent a lot of time. We've looked at a lot of deals, and now we're breaking it down, and we're in a couple of deals together with no outside capital to date. So I can get on that motorcycle and start riding and flush out all these cobwebs or assumptions that I thought about it in reality. And then I can go approach investors and say, look, we've already got a couple of deals under our belt. We're going to go and scale and buy another 10. And the big thing for me is around that synergy of there's a potential cross sell. And again, you've got all the caveats included with the SEC, but there's potential financial advisory firms we can buy. We could even buy bookkeeping firms. There's just a lot of firm, you know, things, synergies within the sort of, we'll call the financial services space, that CPAs are just one element of it that we think are quite synergistic to the overall brand of RSN and, you know, buying multifamily or looking at tax advantages with certain other investment opportunities. Because at the end of the day, we are a private equity company and we look to, you know, raise capital, assess deals and build that culture and, you know, try and be really, really good at asset management.
There are a couple of things that stand out to me. One, I want to make sure our listeners capture, I think, the headline here, which is looking to supplement cash flow and revenue with more cash heavy businesses, right? We know multifamily is great for the long run, right? When you talk about wealth appreciation, being able to take depreciation, all those things, it's a wonderful vehicle. But when you are the operator, particularly when you have LP investors that you're giving those pref returns to, you're not going to see as much of the cash flow. So this is a great way to supplement that business with another business. And you mentioned a lot of the connective tissue. This being, again, in the financial world where a lot of the investors you're talking to are looking to create wealth, you know, as investors in multifamily, we have to have those conversations with CPAs and attorneys and lawyers and all of these other professional services anyway. So we build up a lot of that knowledge and those relationships. So there is a lot of connective tissue there. And then to your point, there is a lot of the same thing, especially when you have partners who have that background at M&As, who understand the accounting world, who can bring some of the things that maybe you don't have to the table. Your focus is more the private equities, bringing investors, helping them see how to analyze deals. How do they deliver a return? How do they identify risk and upside in a potential deal? And a lot of those things are transferable outside of multifamily. So I know a lot of folks, you know, when they got into multifamily, they started to look at maybe self-storage or mobile homes, and those are very natural progressions, but now there's an opportunity where there's opportunities in businesses that are not necessarily in the brick and mortar real estate, but more in, you know, affiliated businesses that service multifamily and in some cases have nothing to do with multifamily. But I love the fact that you're in that space and breaking down kind of how you're able to grow and scale. You're doing this with a couple of partners. You mentioned right now you're not taking LP capital. You guys are just kind of doing this yourself. You've gone through various partnerships. How, like, what have you learned over your career about approaching partnerships that our listeners can keep in mind whenever we're evaluating groups to partner with and to look and go into business together?
Yeah, look, I think at the end of the day, partnerships, they are very valuable, right? They help scale one person. Like my first ever partner, I've had many partners over the years. And you've got to understand that it may not last forever. So that's the first thing. The second thing is you've got to have a synergy, right? There's got to be a yin to their yang. You don't want to partner up with someone who's really good at exactly the things that you are good at. The reason you go get a partner is because you're deficient in one area. So make sure you're partnering up with some folks, and then just make sure you know the rules of engagement are clearly defined within an operating agreement. You know, because if it does come to an end, which it probably will, you know, you want to look to like the accounting stuff. Like we know with Kevin and Daniela, his wife, like, this is going to be a 5-year project and we're looking to exit in 5 years. We've got benchmarks of what we want to hit in terms of total EBITDA, and we will look to exit, right? It's not forever. And when you go into it knowing that, it's, I'll call it a midterm sprint, but this is not going to be the next 30 years of my life. And that's where I think you've got to also understand in terms of partnership. So they're very, very useful for helping build a business in the beginning, because you're a solo entrepreneur, you know, trying to build, you know, go and take down the world.
I really appreciate the comment, but also as I listen to you share your journey, I mean, you've gotten to know your partners well over the years, right? So you talk about the gentleman who was a mate of yours, Australian, you know, there's a KP on your first deal. Like, those are long standing relationships where you guys got a chance to get to know each other, see how you operate, see how you show up, see that level of commitment. So it makes it a lot easier to partner, because now you pretty much are just talking about the deal and how you work together, as opposed to vetting the character of the individual. I'm sure you see a lot of people who partner maybe a little too quickly or don't do a lot of vetting before jumping into partnerships. What advice or feedback would you give someone who is looking to partner?
There's partner building a business, and then there's sort of like LP partners, like you're investing in deals. Like, quickly with LPs, I think there's the Jobs Act changed the space. You can go and place your money in multiple different operators, and you can sort of test the waters with relatively low investments that, you know, you're not going to put all your eggs in one basket. So I highly encourage people, when LP investors come to me, I'm like, I'd love to be your portion of equity and love all your money, but like, also go and invest with 3 or 4 other operators. I do the same thing personally. It helps diversify. In terms of the other side of the coin of like getting into bed with someone, you need to your point, have that, build that relationship and see each other work in difficult situations. Now, you're not always going to have those dry runs and what a difficult situation is, but you can sort of get to know someone over a period of months and years to see how they operate. And it's funny how when you hang around the hoop long enough, you'll start to see who is best suited to you. And it's just sort of, you know, the world works in weird ways that bring investors and partners together. And the partners that I've had over the years, I never thought I'd have partners today. And it's just, you know, things can happen in strange ways.
My big takeaway kind of goes back to where we started the conversation. You know, you're someone I've known for, I guess, almost 10 years now, and watching your growth and development, and we've had a chance to sit down together a couple times. I came out to LA some years ago and we talked about underwriting, and you were a guy who really sat and helped me understand that. And I bring all this up because I think it's important for people to understand the character of people when the cameras aren't on, right? And to be able to sit and have those conversations. And we never talked about any kind of monetary, you know, exchange or anything like that. We just sat down and vibed and, hey, here's how I'm doing this, and here's how I do this, or here's my model for this. And I really appreciate that. But I think it also just goes to show how people approach the business. And if you are looking to partner with people, you want to find people who think the way you think, but bring a different skill set to the table. And that's what makes great partnerships. Doesn't mean everything's always going to be great. Doesn't mean every deal is going to be a home run, but you definitely want to at least understand the character of the individuals that you're looking to partner with. So I really appreciate the way you approach the business from that perspective, and obviously wish you the best. Hey, for folks who do want to learn more, first of all, you've written a couple books. We kind of breezed past that. You mentioned one of your co-authors. I've got that book right here.
I think 10,000 Miles
in America. I grabbed one, but it was not the right one. This is your Investing in the U.S. Real Estate book. Yeah, there's another one that you co-wrote, I think is up there somewhere. But you've written a couple books. If people want to check those out, where do they find them?
Yeah, look, the easiest way to find them is Google my name, Reed Goossens, R-E-E-D-G-O-O-S-S-E-N-S. A lot of O's and S's and E's in there. The other way is just go to rsmpropertygroup.com. That's the sort of the multifamily side of the business. And we are launching the accounting side soon, it's going to be called Accounting First Group. I'm actually heading the Best Ever Conference this year. So if you are going, please, yeah, reminder, get your tickets. Come over and say g'day, grab a coffee, grab a beer. I'm always really down to earth and try to, you know, share some knowledge with folks. Yeah, that's the best way to get in contact with me. If you're ever coming through Los Angeles, hit me up, Reed at rsnpropertygroup.com.